Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 200, part 2 of The True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
So obviously this is the second of a two-part episode. So if you haven't yet listened to part 1, please go back and do so, or you're going to be super lost.
You are going to be lost. Part 1 is required.
It is. Now, we know that you've been eagerly awaiting what happens next, so we're not going to make you wait a second longer. So, John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course.
Where we left off at the end of last episode, the East Side Killer had been stalking the bar scene of Bellevue, Washington, in the summer of 1990. He had claimed the lives of 27-year-old Mary Ann Polry and 35-year-old mother of two, Carol Beathy. We established that the MO of the killer was to use a hands-on method of murder, which he did switch up, and then to pose the bodies in a sexually degrading way. The murders occurred 47 days apart, and he seemed to be escalating in rage and violence. The friend of the first victim and the ex-boyfriend of the second were both considered early suspects. However, their blood type did not match the blood type gained from the semen sample left at both scenes. So the killer was still on the loose and ready to strike again.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
Now, something that is interesting about this person being dubbed the East Side Killer by the media so quickly is the fact that he technically was not a serial killer yet. Because to officially be called a serial killer, you have to have three victims. And he only has two.
I agree with you. I mean, that is a little odd. Usually you don't see that, but I know this is going to sound so wrong, but like, did they just think that this person would just strike again, so they're just getting ahead of it?
Well,
or trying to get awareness to it, so they are overhyping it? I don't know. I don't know if I'm wording this correctly.
I know what you're saying, like maybe potentially to warn the population of Bellevue, Washington, like this guy's out here, so you guys should be really careful.
I think so, because there's no other reason why you would do that. You can't coin him something if he's not hitting the...
Well, there is a reason.
Okay.
Now, the reason for this is that the population, in hearing that there was a serial killer in the area, was up in arms because they had just dealt with one years prior. So I think the media remembered how much newspapers they sold when another serial killer was in the area, and they're, you know, really apt to kind of jump on this. So who I'm talking about is the Green River Killer. So remember, we're in 1990, so 6 years prior would be 1984, and the Green River Killer had been active in the area during that time. However, he had moved on. So the thought process was, is this a new serial killer, or could he be back? It seemed improbable because the MO and the victimology was very different, but the fear of there being a serial killer in the area was definitely back. Because remember, the Green River Killer was not caught, Gary Ridgway, until 2001.
It's a long time for that person to be active, just out there.
Very active.
I actually don't know enough about him.
Oh, it's very fascinating.
I actually don't. I mean, I mean, I've heard the name a million times.
See, this is why I always like picking cases that people haven't heard a lot of before, because I think those are always very interesting to cover in the true crime space that becomes oversaturated with the same cases over and over again. But it's always so funny because cases that us as like true crime junkie people are so obsessed with and know so well, you just have no clue about. So that's why sometimes I want to do the well-known ones with you, because you would be shocked.
Yeah, like, I feel like, I mean, I know a few. Like, I know, obviously, you know, you have the whole OJ thing. You have, I think.
I would never cover the OJ
thing. No, I know that. For sure. I mean, I know the West Memphis 3 whole situation there. Mm-hmm. Like, I know a few.
I made John watch those documentaries.
Yeah. Well, that's probably why. But, like, yeah, I don't, I know, I mean, I know the name, but I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, well, so. He was a truck driver, which made it very easy for him to be a serial killer. But he also picked up prostitutes. He had also picked up people with, like, his child in the car. So they're unassuming.
I see. You know what? There would be, I feel like, a time where we should, like, maybe on Patreon we can do something where it's, like, covering those cases.
The well-known, like, the cases side, that John just doesn't know.
That I just don't know. Like, I heard the name or something coined, but never really.
No, we might get to it.
We'll maybe see. One of these days.
I mean, listen, if we do this for another 8 years, we'll
need to do it.
We'll need to cover it.
Sure. Sorry, guys. I don't mean to go off on a tangent here, but.
It's okay. So in order to put the population at ease from what the media was kind of like stirring up with them, the police force decided to establish a task force to help deal with this person. But it seemed like most of the time the task force was just following up on the hundreds of leads that came in versus being able to truly immerse themselves in the investigation and case files. Of all the tips that came in, the only one of relevance was a man that Marianne had dated. This man's name was David, and some people had met him and described him as being intense and dark. And they said that he gave off bad vibes, and the two had just had a bad breakup. Investigators were finally able to track this David down, but he told them that it had just been a casual relationship. So casual that things never even could have ended badly. He didn't even have to officially end things. And he provided law enforcement with a solid alibi. He was taken quickly off the list. Another tip was from Marianne's friends, who stated that Marianne did have a habit of leaving bars with strangers that she had met. Whether it was to go outside for air or smoke, or to leave for a little bit. They said that they had spoken to her about this and warned her how dangerous it could be, but she told them that it was never anything serious because she wasn't sleeping with these men.
Okay.
So we know she's vulnerable to leave with the stranger, and that was something that the police thought she had done because her belongings had been left inside the bar.
Right, so she might have thought she was coming back. Maybe something, a struggle maybe happened outside when she was out there.
Exactly.
Hmm.
So 25 days after Carol's murder, the investigative task force into the East Side Killer would get the message that they were not working fast enough, when a third murder would take place. 24-year-old Andrea Levine, who went by the nickname of Randy, rented a basement apartment from a couple in Bellevue, the Hayeses. It was a very affordable apartment with a separate entrance and a nice couple who gave her space. It was the perfect setup for a young girl out on her own. On the night of August 30th, 1990, Robert Hayes saw Andrea when she returned from work. It was unknown to him because he and his wife were fast asleep, but the 24-year-old chose to go out that night. Andrea met her boyfriend at a restaurant in Kirkland, which is about a 15-minute drive north of Bellevue. Andrea drove herself home afterwards, refusing an offer from her boyfriend to do so. And this was around 1:30 a.m. Robert Hayes and his wife awoke that morning at 5 a.m. As part of the couple's routine, Hayes opened the back door and let their dog out. As soon as he was let out, their dog began barking wildly, which drew the attention of Robert. He stepped outside of his house to investigate, and he saw what he described as a dark figure about 30 feet away. He said that because it was dark out, and the only thing he could make out about this person was the fact that it was an adult male. Robert said that he called out to the person who was on his property, but when he did so, they fled. He pursued them, but stopped shortly thereafter because he realized that he was unarmed and that this was probably an unsafe thing to do. He did call the police, and they investigated the scene, but they found nothing. Unfortunately, the search that night did not extend into Andrea's apartment.
That's actually really scary.
Yeah.
You know, you stumble upon somebody that's outside that you can't really make out because it's too dark. And then it's like,
what do you do?
What do you do? And then that first person's instinct was to go after them.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would do that because you just never know. That could just be a trap for you to be, get out there. You could be the next victim.
You come on, could man. Be. I mean, he interrupted basically the killer leaving the scene.
Yeah.
And just to like go back and talk about the timeline here, there was 47 days between victim one and two. And between victim two and three, there's only been 25 days, meaning that the time frame is lessening between murders, which is an escalation. Now, we know that there's a physical escalation with the violence between victim one and victim two, especially post-mortem, but now we're seeing an escalation in time as well.
Very scary that someone out there can do something like this and it's just commonplace.
Start it and then not be able to stop themselves.
Yeah.
Doing it again.
Crazy.
The Hayeses made note that weekend that they had not seen Andrea, which was odd. On Monday, when Hayes's wife saw Andrea's cat in the window, who appeared to be hungry, she decided that she would enter the apartment to feed or check on the cat. As soon as she walked into the apartment, she said that she smelled the distinct smell of old blood, a smell that got stronger the further she walked down the hallway towards Andrea's bedroom. When she opened the door, she found Andrea's body, posed in the same grotesque way the other victims had been. The police were called, and again the detectives working on the East Side Killer case were called, and the crime scene team went to work. It was very obvious that Andrea was the third victim. Andrea had died from severe multiple head wounds inflicted with an object noted to be similar to that of an iron bar. It was also determined that the stab wounds that covered her body had been made post-mortem. She, too, had been explicitly posed. She was found on her bed, laying on her back, unclothed, same as Carol. Her legs were spread with her knees extended straight. Her right arm was extended over her shoulder, while her left arm rested by her side. Beneath her left forearm, so tucked under her arm, was the book entitled More Joy of Sex. So that's kind of like the sequel book, the part two of The Joy of Sex, which was a best-selling book, as was this one. There was also a sex toy inserted partially into her mouth. An autopsy would later reveal that she, like the other victims, had been sexually assaulted. The rage of these murders was escalating. The post-mortem stab wounds were plentiful and covered her from her shoulders to the bottom of her torso. It seemed their killer was getting more angry and killing again within a smaller time frame. When it came to forensic evidence, little was found at the scene. Same as Carol's bedroom, the area seemed to have been wiped down because no fingerprints were found, or because the killer had worn gloves. At the scene, fibers and hairs were detected on the bed. Based on testing, the hairs that were found were attributed to that of an African-American male. Now, this was an interesting revelation because all the suspects that police had considered thus far had been white. And now it means that they couldn't be considered in the murder if this were to be the person who committed the murders. On the other hand, based on the posing of the body, there was no way that this was not the same killer because the posing details had been left out of any reports and not given to the press to both maintain the dignity of the victims and withhold information for investigative purposes.
I actually have a question flag.
yes.
that we're going to put here, because I think that this murder specifically, I think, seems a little different, because I feel like this time, I think he's trying to like make her look bad.
Yeah.
Or make it look like she's somebody that she's not.
Right.
You know, like the sex toy.
The sex book.
The sex book. Yeah. Because we don't know if she was reading that book. I mean, we could probably find that out through friends or whoever. But
well, she definitely owned it.
Okay, but it's weird that that's been posed with her.
Yeah.
So it's like to suggest that she is provocative or something along those lines.
Right, or promiscuous.
Promiscuous, yeah, sure.
I agree with you. I think that he's definitely trying to not just humiliate these victims, but make them look a certain way. And I think he did that also with Carol, and then more so this victim, and not as much with Marianne at first, which, like you're saying, could lead us to believe that maybe he knew Carol and Andrea to an extent that he didn't know Marianne. And there's a reason as to why he's depicting these women certain ways.
Right. I feel like it hasn't been this obvious before. I mean, we kind of started to see it on the second victim, but here especially, it's like in your face.
And sometimes it's interesting because a serial killer can be triggered by one event which takes place that might not have been planned. For instance, if he just randomly met Marianne at Papagayo's, which is inferred and kind of was able to charm and maneuver her out of the bar, and then something happened that escalated into him murdering her. And then now he's going and getting the victims that he wanted to get. And that's why those crimes look a little different. And they both occurred in their homes, in their beds.
Right.
So it implies a personal connection with them.
Right, the second and the third, whereas the first one, it was
left
different.
Outside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot going on here. Another interesting thing that's happening is, now in the true crime world, this is kind of I don't want to call it a controversial topic, but usually, and I think this was kind of a thing that was perpetuated by, I'm sorry, John, your beloved BAU, Behavioral Analysis Unit at the FBI, that most serial killers are white males. Now, that statistic is very true. Most serial killers that we know of are white males. But another thing that's really true is that, unfortunately, in our society, Black women, or even Black men, especially Black men that are gay, are considered less than victims, right? Those are the crimes that aren't investigated, especially crimes in bad neighborhoods. We've seen that with multiple Black serial killers that eventually were caught because they were so brazen, they just never thought they were going to be captured. And what some true crime analysts say is that the reason we don't know about more Black serial killers is because they're crimes are not being investigated.
That's pretty sad.
Very sad.
Isn't that like the Atlanta child killer, right?
Yes. That's one of them, the Atlanta child killer. Then there's also like the Bayou Strangler, the Grim Sleeper, Samuel Little. Like there's many of these men that had so many victims, more than white serial killers, because they had gone undetected for so long.
That's really sad.
Very sad. So it's interesting and kind of was shocking to the task force that they needed to shift their focus and not listen to what the FBI keeps telling them about serial killers, that they're looking for an African-American male.
That's what the BAU was telling them?
Well, that's what the BAU kind of has expressed in their thought process, because whenever you hear a profile, it's always a white male in their 20s or 30s that hates their mom.
That hates their mom. Like, yeah, I hear you.
So it's a revelation to them and not something that they were expecting, because everyone they had considered a suspect was white. And now, with the third murder under his belt, the East Side Killer was officially labeled a serial killer. The investigative task force wanted to get an understanding of their latest victim, so they spoke with Andrea's family about her. Her brother stated that she was a wonderful woman. She was young and she was just enjoying life. She loved to go out and spend time with her friends, which meant the victimology was the same: an unmarried young woman who frequented the bar scene of Bellevue. Social and trusting. When it came to her last whereabouts, it took some time to figure out what had happened because she hadn't been seen in days. Finally, they were able to track her last known whereabouts to the night that she had spent with her boyfriend on Friday, August 30th, which then brought them to the attention of the police report that had been filed at the residence from the landlord when he saw an adult figure on his property that night, dressed in dark clothing and running from the scene. So they put together that the landlord had seen the serial killer
leaving.
Yes. One other interesting piece of information that the police discovered when asking the family if anything was out of place or missing from Andrea or the scene was the detail of a ring. Her family said that Andrea had loved a ring that had been given to her from her grandmother, and she wore it constantly, never took it off, and it was missing from her body. The ring itself was very unique and easily identifiable. It was a yellow gold ring with ornate designs surrounding a marquise-shaped amethyst gemstone. Another reason why this is an interesting detail was because Carol Beathy also had missing rings from her hands when her body was discovered.
So are we talking about a memento?
Maybe.
Possibly that he's keeping from his victims.
So the task force, when it came to Carol's rings, when they found out about that, had gone as far as to publish the rings in a local newspaper in hopes that the killer had tried to sell them. So they were planning on doing a similar thing about Andrea's ring. Investigators wanted to speak with Andrea's friends because they knew that the killer seemed to be stalking the Bellevue bar scene, and it would be her friends that would know more about that side of her life than her family would. Plus, like you said, it did seem to be very personal. They spoke to them about Andrea and what had been going on in her life. Were there fights with her boyfriend? Had she met anyone out that night? One of her friends revealed that one night, not too long ago, while they were all out at a bar, Andrea was approached by a man that she seemed to know. The two talked for a while, and when he left, Andrea made a comment that she thought he was very good looking. They asked what this man looked like, and they said they knew him. His name was George Russell. He was African-American and very well-dressed.
Okay, so this could be our guy.
It could potentially be. Could Russell be the contributor to the hair found at the crime scene? Through further questioning of those who knew Andrea, they found out that she had actually been introduced to Russell through her boyfriend. One night, when Andrea couldn't drive home, her boyfriend volunteered to drive her back from the bar to her house in her truck while his friend, George Russell, followed behind them. So George is going to drive the friend's car there, so then once they drop her off, the two friends can leave in his car. There was also another occasion where George Russell accompanied Andrea's boyfriend to help replace her car battery. So not only is he familiar with this victim, if this is George Russell, he also knows where she lives.
That's true. Right. So she like knows him, but doesn't like really know him, just kind of on the fringe there.
So like technically that time that he had approached her at the bar was the third time they had an encounter together.
Okay.
But it seemed like she was kind of into him. They also learned some information about George Russell pertaining to Andrea's murder. According to those who knew him, because they kind of ran in the same social circle, Russell had some pretty disparaging things to say about Andrea after finding out about her death. He said she slept around, she used men, she was a whore. And people thought this was an odd thing to say about a woman who had just been brutally murdered. And that goes to kind of like what you said, where he's trying to make her out to look promiscuous in the posing of her body. And these were the things that he was saying about her upon finding out, in quotes, about her death.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a red flag. It's just that we don't have anything necessarily to connect him to that other than, you know, saying awful things about somebody. You know what I mean?
Right. Especially potentially knowing her a hair.
Was murdered. Yeah.
So we're going to have to make a physical connection between the two. Investigators had their work kind of cut out for them here. But luckily, they have semen that was at the scene. So because this stood out to them, they brought Russell in for questioning. He did have an extensive criminal history of petty crimes like burglaries, break-ins, drug arrests, and truancy as a teenager, but nothing violent like they saw with the victims. The detectives who questioned him described him as a charming man who was really good at changing topics and dominating a conversation and swaying it in the direction he wanted it to go. They recognized his ability to make people feel comfortable, at ease, which is something he would have had to do to his victims.
That's true. Another red flag. But here's the thing, though. Once again, there's nothing, that's not a physical thing that you connect, that you can connect him to it.
Yeah.
But it is odd now that you have these two things that would explain this person perfectly, right?
Yeah.
Actually, you can even go a step further, right? Because he's had run-ins with police on things like burglary and other stuff. And that second and third murder was done in the house. Could you make the argument that he is proficient at breaking into homes? So that would also line up decently with the second and third murder.
I think that's a really good thing to bring up because it's interesting. We do see a correlation between people who escalate to sexual assault and murder and their original crimes being break-ins and burglaries. For some reason, it's like they begin with that and then that's what it turns into. The fantasy morphs and develops into the sexual assault and murder.
Very interesting.
Yes. The detectives were prepared for this behavior because they had already asked around about George Russell. Apparently, he was also very well known in the Bellevue bar scene. He was described as being a charismatic guy who was always the center of attention with the crowd around him. He was a charmer and the life of the party, the kind of guy that could talk his way in or out of anything. So as they were having the conversation, the detectives transitioned into the murders that had been taking place. And he decided to use the tactic of showing the victims. He took out a picture of all three victims, and he asked George Russell if he knew any of the women in the pictures, and he said he did not. Now, they knew this was a lie because he definitely knew Andrea. They asked him again if he was sure that he didn't see any of those women at Papagayo's, a place where they and he was known to frequent. Russell admitted that he was a patron of Papagayo's, but that he didn't know any of them. Then they confronted him and said, "Well, that's odd, George, because Randy knew you," referring to Andrea. This knowledge held by detectives made him nervous, and that was when Russell shut down. He told them that he was done talking and that he wanted to speak to his attorney. Because they had nothing to hold him on, they let him know that he was free to go.
That's very odd. That's another red flag. This guy has three red flags already for me.
Yeah.
I haven't whipped out the red flags in a long time, yeah. By the way.
And this guy has a bouquet of them.
Yeah. It is bizarre. Why lawyer? I mean, listen, I understand why you might want to lawyer up, because we have seen cases where it's like it's blown out of proportion.
Well, this is someone also familiar with the judicial system, what police could have the potentiality to do. He's a black man. So I understand the wanting to have the protection of a lawyer. The other things are what really concern me. His charisma, the fact that he knew this victim.
And then said that he didn't.
Yeah.
Or I should say he said that he didn't know them, but they know for a fact that
he knew Andrea.
At least one of them.
Right.
That's bizarre.
And if you really did frequent the bar, I mean, look, people that worked at this bar knew Marianne. And then when they later go back to the bar and they question the employees at Papagayos about George Russell, they knew who he was. So there's no way that they didn't have interactions.
Yeah, it can't be that big of a bar scene to not know.
No, it's a small, it's a suburb. Right. So
he's lying. He has to be. I just wonder if he's the guy or he's just covering for somebody or he just knows more than he wants to share.
Everything's possible. So they got the feeling that this really might be their guy, though. So they sent the task force out to Papagayos to question the staff about any potential interactions between Russell and the victims and to re-interview everyone they could think of. But now they were going to ask them about Russell. From that, the task force learned something interesting. A Bellevue police officer who had been working off duty the night of Marianne's murder as a doorman said that he saw George Russell twice that night. He said he knew George Russell well because he was a frequent patron of the restaurant and that he had seen him first around 10:30 p.m. at the beginning of his shift. And then again about an hour later, when he told the officer that he was going to leave for a bit to take this girl over to her place and get something. The officer could not properly identify the woman, but he described her appearance and size to be that similar to Marianne Polrai. He also noted that the woman seemed to be very intoxicated. So this police officer, doorman, saw him leave with Marianne and that she was drunk, which is corroborated by her toxicology report.
I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, we're definitely in the right direction, but I still don't know. I mean, the only way to really confirm this is if we can just get his sample, right? I mean, at
his
this
DNA
point.
DNA sample. Yeah. Well, I think they're going in the direction where they can most definitely apply to get a warrant for it. And the friends of Carol Beathy stated that she and Russell were acquaintances.
Okay.
Look, see, you were right.
Yeah.
He really did know Carol and Andrea, which is why their murders were a little different than Marianne's.
Yes.
They had seen each other around the bar scene that they were both a part of. And they were, so the bar scene around Bellevue was small. A lot of people knew each other. And the normal pattern of the night would be once the bars closed, a lot of the people that were still up and ready to do stuff would go to a Denny's in Overlake. So Carol and Russell were two of these people. So they often spent many late nights together. Not necessarily together, but with large groups of people.
Right, with others, right, mm-hmm. Okay.
Plus, she had been a bartender at Cucina Cucina, a place where Russell also frequented.
I mean, it looks just too good to, mm-hmm. you know, it looks like it's not going in his favor at
and
all.
Then, hold on, this is a huge piece of information.
Okay, hit me.
I'm going to blow everything out of the water with this one.
Hit me with it.
One of Carol's friends who worked at the Black Angus restaurant, sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is where Marianne's body was dumped. Said that she remembered a situation where Carol was trying to tell her something about George Russell at the Black Angus restaurant, but then stopped because they both caught Russell glaring at them. This same friend also said that Russell had been furious when a few bad incidents at the restaurant's bar led to George Russell being banned from the establishment. So police theorized that the reason why Marianne's body was dumped at the Black Angus restaurant was an FU to them because they had banned him from the restaurant.
Oh, wow. Okay, maybe we're on to something.
And he would hang out with Carol there.
I'd be like really upset if like all of this would like looks like it could go and like him being the guy, but then it's not.
And it's not. Yeah, that would be wild.
But it is insane that like, if not, right, look how much stuff is in this guy's, mm-hmm. against this guy, I should say.
Right. And it would be such a coincidence if that none of it really culminated to him being the killer.
A massive coincidence, and I don't like to believe in coincidences.
Okay. Well, they also spoke with some of Russell's friends. They admitted that he had also said disparaging things about Carol, as you know, like he did with Andrea when he found out she had been murdered. So he seems to really be talking badly about these women, which shows he has an anger or an aggression towards them or a dislike towards them, which the killer would have in order to do what they did. And they discovered that about 3 weeks after Carol's murder, just before Andrea was murdered, George Russell and a friend had driven out to a wooded area on Mercer Island, where he said he had to pick up some money that was owed to him. He went out into the woods, and when he returned, he did so with a paper bag full of silver dollars. Now, Carol's ex-husband said that sometimes Carol would receive tips at the bar in Canadian silver dollars, and she would save them in paper bags in her drawers. And when she had been murdered, those paper bags were missing from her dressers.
Right. I mean, that's bizarre, too, because who would know about, I mean.
Well, I mean, if someone searched the room and was opening drawers, they would find a paper bag full of silver dollars and take them. I mean, it's cash.
It's, some people would say it's maybe better. And some, you know, it's, you know, there's value there. There's metal value there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting.
So because of this, Carol's sheets were reexamined. And upon reexamination, hairs similar to those found at Andrea's crime scene were found. However, those hairs were so short and small that they weren't suitable for testing and why they hadn't been found upon first examination. So they also found African-American hairs in Carol's sheets, but they couldn't be tested.
Okay.
So this is all very telling information, but nothing was concrete. There was no true physical evidence yet before they make any connections. But that was until a tip came forward about the ring that was missing from Andrea's person. A woman had come into the police station and said that someone had given her a ring and that she believed it was the one that they were looking for. When she described the ring Andrea's grandmother had given her to a T, they brought her in for further questioning about the situation. She said that after Andrea's murder, George Russell had asked her to go out on a date. She agreed, but he had stood her up. He never showed. Afterwards, he called her to apologize for not showing up, but said he wanted to see her again, and he promised that he had something for her that would make it up to her.
No.
A peace offering.
No. Is it the ring?
He gave her the ring.
Oh, man. That is the most damning piece of evidence that we have.
Oh, totally.
You shouldn't have that.
You should not have that ring, sir. So they asked her if she still had the ring, but she said she did not. She said, I didn't want to keep the ring because Russell's behavior creeped her out. She said she got a really bad vibe from him and he kind of scared her. And she didn't want anything to do with him or anything to do with him. So she just kind of gave the ring to a friend of hers. So they tracked down this friend who recently hitchhiked to Florida and pawned the ring once she got there.
Oh, man.
It's like, oh, my God, Florida's the other side of the country. So they track down this pawn shop and they go there. When they visit the pawn shop, the investigators were relieved to find that the ring was still there.
Okay, that is really lucky that they can grab that. Because if it's there, how did it get there? And then the whole story will unfold.
Exactly.
And plus with her testimony, I mean, this is looking pretty good for us to figure out who did this, but bad for him.
But still circumstantial.
True. Because
he could say he got the ring from somebody else, just as she did.
He could.
Andrea's sister-in-law was able to go to the pawn shop and confirm that the ring belonged to the family. So at one point, for some reason or another, George Russell had in possession Andrea's ring. After this was confirmed, a search warrant was obtained for George Russell's home. At his residence, they found books on crime scene investigation and a black duffel bag in which there was a rope, gloves, and other items that made it appear as a rape kit of sorts. Then the detectives were finally able to find another of Russell's friends that had even more troubling information. This friend's name was Smith McLean. On the night of Marianne's murder, George Russell had gone to Papagayo's with McLean. McLean claimed that when he picked up George Russell for the night, he had with him a black duffel bag, which shows planning.
Yes.
And he kept it in the truck when they went into the restaurant. Obviously, he didn't bring the duffel bag with him. At one point in the night, Russell asked McLean for his keys. He said he had to go home and change into a collared shirt because that was the required dress attire for the dance floor at the bar. McLean gave him the keys. George Russell never returned with the truck. McLean said that he was upset and that after, you know, they had spent the night at the bar, he figured he would go to Denny's in hopes that he would see Russell there because Russell always ended up at Denny's at the end of the night in Overlake. But he never showed up with his truck. He essentially stole his truck.
That is extremely odd behavior.
Very. So the following morning, McLean said that according to his sister, George Russell showed up at 6 a.m. with his truck. Russell told her that he had borrowed the truck to drive a friend home. When his sister looked at the truck, she saw that there was a reddish-brown stain on the passenger seat. Russell explained it away, saying that his friend had vomited up clam chowder, which is so gross.
Oh, that is so gross.
I'm sorry, guys.
Don't say it again.
I won't. McLean's sister offered Russell a ride home, but he declined. He just grabbed his black duffel bag and walked home.
And no one else thought that was weird in the moment.
Yeah, but they didn't associate it with a murder.
You know what? But we would now.
Well, we would now.
It's like all these cases have prepared us for all of it.
If we ever get exposed to a murder.
I mean, I hope we never do, but I'm just saying, like, dude, you borrowed my truck. You didn't bring it back right away. There's weird stains in here.
Red stains.
I would be.
You have your weird duffel bag.
Yeah, I would be questioning everything with this guy.
Yeah. So that is how he would have means to kill Marianne, because her body was left a mile away from the bar where she had left. So like we said, he would need privacy to do this. Well, here's a vehicle. And he would need a means to move the body with the truck. So the truck was taken into police custody in October of 1990 and more thoroughly examined. Unfortunately, the truck's interior had been cleaned. However, the floor mats had not. He said that the floor mats, which he had made from leftover cut carpet from inside the house, which is very dangerous, sir, because it can get stuck under your brake pedals, was removed from the truck because they smelled so bad after Russell had taken the truck.
Ew.
I know. So he put those floor mats in his garage, and the floor mats were taken by police. The fibers of those floor mats were a match for fibers found in the combing of Marianne's pubic hair.
Okay. Well, that is...
That's physical evidence.
Physical evidence that we needed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The upholstery, although cleaned, reacted positively for blood and antigens that matched the vaginal swab taken at Marianne's autopsy. It's very confusing the way they had to do like blood typing back in the 1990s, but basically what they were able to determine was the blood that was found inside the vehicle could not be attributed to George Russell or Smith McLean. It could only be attributed to Marianne Polry.
Which puts her in the car.
Correct.
And I think that in this case, this might be good enough.
Yes. And the testing of Russell's blood also revealed that he could have been the secretor that produced the semen found on the two victims. So his blood type matched the semen found at two scenes. George Russell was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder. He was described, like, in the public as being this... He went by the East Side Killer, but also the charmer, the charming murderer. So they were saying that he was able to charm these women and then ended up killing them. Russell's trial began on September 13th, 1991. The trial lasted 6 weeks, and the jury deliberated for 2 days. It was hard for them to understand the DNA evidence.
What a world, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, now it wouldn't really be as questioned, I'm sure.
Well, think about it. It was revolutionary.
Yeah.
I said I would never talk about OJ, but here we are talking about OJ again. But during the OJ trial, and that was years later.
Right.
So this is the very beginnings of DNA technology.
I guess if I was a juror, I guess I'd, if, you know, living in that time, they're going through this, I guess I would be a little confused about it too.
It is confusing because it was so technical, the way in which they had to do this with the blood antigens and the different typings. And that would be confusing to people who are juries of people's peers, because we're just normal people who aren't scientists.
Right. We're just laymans. We don't.
Yeah.
We don't know all the science behind it. But then again, though, I'm sure they had a professional to kind of bridge that gap.
Well, they tried. But listen, Right. Let me tell you something about science people, because it happens with science people and math people in schools and high schools. They don't connect well to people. You know what I mean? Like, they're very intelligent, and sometimes their intelligence comes off as arrogance. That doesn't always work well on the stand.
I see what you're saying.
But after those 2 days, the jury decided that there was enough evidence to convict George Russell. He was found guilty on all counts and was sentenced to 3 life terms. Russell has tried to appeal, saying the DNA tests were not reliable, but all such appeals have been denied because the DNA testing had only been reaffirmed as science has increased. So he's still in jail.
Well, I mean, the evidence kind of proved his... Well, the evidence proved his guilt. And, I mean, he is where he belongs. I mean, these were very sexually violent crimes.
They were, and they were only escalating. I mean, you're going from 47 days apart to 25 days apart, and the violence, the grotesqueness was only growing. So what was going to happen within the next month? Another murder, most likely. I mean, nothing seemed to be stopping him. And his anger was very evident. Even after these women were murdered, he still had disparaging things to say about them.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I think that probably...
So no remorse.
Yeah, I think that probably made people question, like, you know, is this guy involved? I mean, because if I was sitting there and someone was saying that to someone who's just been brutally murdered, I would question their behavior.
Like, yeah, I'd question my friendship.
Yeah, like, hey, man, what's going on with you, man?
Right.
You know, like, why would you say that about her? It's crazy.
Well, it's, in a way, it could also be justifying what he did. Well, they were terrible people.
I could see that as well. Mm-hmm. He's trying to justify what he did.
So, still in jail, the East Side Killer. It's good that he got caught, though.
Oh, absolutely. Because he would have done it again.
He would have. Okay, guys, before we go, what we want to do is we want to say thank you to our newest Patreon supporters. We appreciate you donating money, and we love that you get to listen to 2 bonus episodes a month and no ads, which is always really nice, especially when you're trying to go to bed to the lovely sounds of our true crime voices. So thank you to Christy Blair, Emma, Jacob, Kelly Pantos, Brittany T., Justin Barton, Adam, Megan Sullivan, Nicole Strength, Grace Dennison, Julie T., Rout DeMary, Dana Miles, J.R. McCoy, Melanie Ridgway, Cheyenne, Alessia McGuire, A Foxy Lady, Liz, Melinda, May Thu Kine, Minnow, Jennifer Pinikowski, Jen Sensini, Mary Kay Bond, Tony, Jane Valentine, Brittany Traynor, Easton Weston, Misty Grove, Rebecca Ford, Melissa Mills, and Kim Klein. We hope you're enjoying your Patreon subscriptions. And until next time, guys, don't park next to Vance.
Bye, guys.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.